This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, why are the people of Ivory Coast worried about a shipment of ammonium nitrate in the port in Abidjan?
Because for months it has been said by the ship manager that it is fertilizer. But now the port of Abidjan says that the client is a mining group. So suggests that the user is a mining one, and then the danger are stronger.
Also a fascinating conversation about the Bayfal of Senegal. Rokia Boule, winner of the Komla Dumor Award for this year, has been to Touba, the holy city of the Bayfal, to find out how they differ from other Muslims in Senegal.
When you see a Bayfal in Senegal, they have a striking appearance, their dreads, the way that they dress, and most importantly, their unorthodox practices. And this has led to some people accusing them of straying too far from Islamic norms. For instance, they do not observe prayers, nor do they fast during the month of Ramadan, and instead their devotion and worship is channeled through labor and service.
It's Monday, the 13th of January. First, we go to Sudan. We are talking about the continuing impact of the war in Sudan on the lives of ordinary people. Over the weekend, the Sudanese armed forces retook a key town from the Rapid Support Forces, the militia it has been battling for nearly 2 years now. The fighting has raged across terrain, women's bodies, and places that were meant to provide safety and healing, places like hospitals. After an escalation of attacks on staff and facilities, the French medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières has withdrawn from the biggest public hospital in Khartoum. The impact of this is devastating for pregnant women, people with serious illnesses and injuries, and children. Let me give you just one statistic to demonstrate how important that hospital is. From the time the war began in April 2023 to December 2024, nearly 4,000 babies drew their first breath at Al-Bashir. But repeated attacks on the hospital is endangering everyone. Armed fighters enter the hospital, threatening staff and demanding that combatants be treated before civilians. Just this past weekend, an ambulance was hijacked. MSF has decided that things cannot go on this way. Dr. Shazir Majid is the surgical care advisor for MSF. He was one of the first doctors to go to Sudan when the war began. He's been telling me why the organization, which has a reputation for being first in and last out in a conflict, had to pull out of Al-Bashir Hospital.
Just to highlight the importance of Bashir Hospital, it's the only hospital in south of Khartoum which provides free medical care. That's how important Bashir is to the south of Khartoum. But in recent months, the teams in the hospital have repeatedly experienced incidents of armed fighting or fighters entering the hospital with weapons and threatening medical staff and often demanding fighters to be treated before civilians. And for us and for the medical teams working in the hospital, it's based on emergencies, right? We use triage. We do not discriminate between fighters, civilians, whomever. We respect international humanitarian law. And it's been difficult for the teams to provide care because, as you know, on the 11th of November, a patient was shot inside the hospital. And on the 18th of December, the attackers fired weapons within the emergency ward, directly threatening medical staff. And also, there have been earlier incidents of weapons being fired at the hospitals, bullets entering the hospital compound, and one person being injured. Now, with such an environment, it's difficult for the medical teams to treat everyone while, let's say, caring for their own safety, right? The staff needs to feel safe, and it's only then they can provide care. So we treat everyone who needs medical attention, and it's irrelevant to us what a person's origin, political conviction, or ethnicity is. The only thing that matters is their medical emergency. And to ensure the safety of all our patients and staff, let's say our hospital and the hospital we support have to be weapon-free zones. Unfortunately, our hospitals were not weapon-free zones because of the repeated incursions by the armed fighters.
When you say repeated incursions, what do you mean? If at all possible, could you describe for us what would typically happen when you're talking about an armed incursion? What do you mean?
It means fighters demanding their colleagues or the other fighters to be treated before other patients and threatening the medical staff to do so. And also violence inside the hospital where one patient was shot on the 11th of November. And on the 18th of December, again, there was weapons were fired at the hospital, bullets entering the hospital compound, so on and so forth.
So not just the overwhelming numbers of people that need help, you're also having to face and confront perhaps armed men who are threatening the staff.
That is correct.
Who are the perpetrators?
So we've named the perpetrators in some of our attacks we've experienced before, but it's always not been clear. So
are you not able to identify them by what they're wearing or whatever?
No, because it's quite difficult. But when we've been sure about who the perpetrators are, then we've been able to identify to which warring party they belong to. But if you would want to have a specific answer to it, what I would say is you could refer back to the previous reports on specific incidents. It's where we've highlighted the perpetrators.
I suppose what would be useful to establish here is, are both sides responsible for these incursions and these threats?
I wouldn't comment on that.
Okay. Just to help us understand, because you saying that you won't comment on that also would give us an understanding of why it would be difficult for you to do so. Just explain why you can't comment on it.
Because we have to be quite specific when we name the perpetrators. So in incidents where we know who the perpetrators are and we could confirm, we've already, let's say we've communicated it. You can go back to our previous press releases. We'll find them there. But it's not just about the perpetrators and the violence in the hospital. It's also much more. For example, it was in October 2023, we had to suspend or temporarily suspend all our surgical activities in the hospital after our supplies were blocked by the Sudanese armed forces. The transport of medical supplies and staff movements from Port Sudan have been blocked for over a year. So it's not just the violence, it's even the medical supplies, which are quite vital to running a surgical hospital or a hospital with maternity and so on and so forth, have been blocked for over a year. And it's multifactorial. In the end, it becomes untenable for MSF to continue in such an atmosphere.
So what happens when MSF leaves?
So currently, before we decided to leave, in the past 20 months, we've had about 60 MSF staff along with 100 staff from Ministry of Health. And what we have done is we have handed over all supplies and equipment to the hospital. And the future of this MOH health facility is in the hands of the authorities. We would very much hope that the medical care will continue and the conditions will change and we will be able to return to South Khartoum and to Bashar Hospital at some point. We really hope so.
What does it feel like? You're a doctor, you know the conditions, and you know that MSF leaves the people who rely on you in a dire situation. I'm just wondering, if, as you reflect on this, it can't be easy.
It's devastating to have to make this decision in face of such great and growing medical needs. Our team, hospital staff, and the volunteers have worked tirelessly in difficult conditions to provide medical care, but without security to operate safely, it becomes untenable to continue when the lives of our staff and patients are threatened.
Is there no way you can secure the security? Because attacking a hospital or shootings in hospitals are war crimes, aren't they?
Yes, so the escalating violence against the healthcare facilities and staff in conflict zones in Sudan is deeply alarming, that's for sure. But to give you a broader picture, as highlighted by the data from WHO recently, in 2024 alone, WHO has verified over 1,200 attacks on healthcare and humanitarian workers across multiple countries, including Sudan, Gaza, and Ukraine. And these attacks have caused significant casualties and disruption to essential services, representing a clear violation of the international humanitarian law. And they worsen the crisis in regions already grappling with immense human suffering and making it increasingly difficult to deliver life-saving aid. And this pattern of violence extends beyond international NGOs, volunteers from local civil groups, including emergency response team in Sudan, for example, have been targeted. The normalization of attacks on healthcare and humanitarian workers in a dire trend that calls for urgent action and upholding international humanitarian law and protecting those delivering essential aid must be a global priority to mitigate the devastating impact. And then for Khartoum in specific, we continue to engage with all stakeholders and reassess the security situation in hopes that we can secure some kind of conditions and security guarantees that would make it possible for us to work safely in Khartoum. It's just a discussion. We do not know where it would lead.
So is MSF completely out of Sudan now, or is it just this particular hospital? Or are you operating elsewhere still?
So MSF continues to work in 11 out of the 18 states in Sudan, including the city of Omdurman in Khartoum state. And we continue to adapt our operations to the needs as the situation changes and respond to emergencies as disease outbreaks and wherever we are needed and have the capacity. But in the south of Khartoum, this was the last hospital which was providing free medical care.
That's Dr. Shazir Majid, the surgical care advisor for Médecins Sans Frontières. In Ivory Coast, people in Abidjan are worried about a ship at the port carrying 20,000 tons of ammonium nitrate. This chemical can be used as fertilizer, but it can also be used to make bombs. It's the same one that caused a huge explosion in Lebanon 4 years ago. More than 500 people died then. In Abidjan, officials have assured the public that all safety measures are in place, but people are uneasy, with good reason. They are remembering that time nearly 20 years ago when toxic waste dumped in the same port and spread to various points around the city led up to 30 officially recognized deaths. Around 30,000 people suffered burns and other effects. That tragedy has left a lasting mark on the people of Abidjan. Charlotte Nithard is an environmental expert and head of the NGO Robin des Bois, which means Robin Hood in French. And she's been telling me that ammonium nitrate is inherently unstable and it can cause a massive explosion if triggered by fire, sparks, accident or misuse. We began our conversation by talking about the risks associated with this particular shipment.
So the risk is accidents. The danger also is dependent on the concentration of the product. And concerning this particular cargo, there is conflicting information from the authorities about the nature of the ammonium nitrate being transported by the Zimrida. The Zimrida, it's the name of the ship, because for months it has been said by the ship manager that it is fertilizer. But now the port of Abidjan says that the client is a mining group. So it suggests that the user is a mining one, and then the danger are stronger, of course. As you may remember, in Lebanon, just 4 years ago, a blast occurred in Beirut, and it was near pure ammonium nitrate, and this product has been left for 6 or 7 years without any proper monitoring, next to fireworks and tires, and some welding works have been done just next to the storage, and that's why it exploded. As I said, it needs a trigger to explode. And the Beirut explosion was one of the most deadly accidents with ammonium nitrate worldwide. But in the recent year, I would say, because at the beginning of the past century, some huge accident also happens, among others, in Germany. But if the product is properly monitored, checked, effect. And if there is no accident and no terrorist attack, for instance, or misused, it is a product commonly transported through the sea worldwide. And the ammonium nitrate fertilizer trade is by sea is estimated at around 20 million tons a year. So it's something really common.
Where is this shipment coming from? Why is it in Abidjan? And where is it going?
So it's a long story. I will try to be as synthetic as possible. The Zimrida is coming from Great Yarmouth in England. And in fact, it loaded a cargo of ammonium nitrate that was originally carried by the Ruby, another ship that suffered damage and could no longer continue its journey. So the product at the beginning was manufactured in Russia, in Kandalaska, in the White Sea, in the Arctic, near Murmansk. And the Ruby with this Russian cargo had this sea accident, this sea problems. So she wasn't able to do its air journey. And the ship has become unwelcome in a lot of Northern and Western Europe countries, including Norway, Sweden, Lithuania, and France. And then she remained at anchor off the Thames estuary for about 1 month. And the English authorities at the end decided to allow, after a lot of controlled check of the cargo, they allowed the ship to go inside English ports, so Great Yarmouth, in order to upload the cargo. And this cargo has been re-uploaded on the Zimrida. So the Zimrida then left Europe and she arrived off Abidjan at the end of December.
December 2024.
Yes, December last year. And
right.
Then the ship anchored off of Abidjan and she was waiting for the authorization to come into the port of Abidjan to dock in Abidjan. And here we are in a very special context because, as you may remember, in Abidjan, the megalopolis of Abidjan has been traumatized in 2006 by the Probo Koala scandal. The Probo Koala was a ship where some refinery of petroleum product with high sulfur content occurs, and the Probo Koala upload some toxic waste in Abidjan, and this waste have been dumped everywhere within Abidjan, outside Abidjan, and according to official estimates, 100,000 intoxication and 16 deaths have been provoked by this ship. So deaths coming from the sea is something very well known from the Abidjan people and by the Ivorian authorities. That's why when the Zimrida asked for the permission to dock, according to the fact that the ammonium nitrate coming from the Ruby has been rejected from a lot and unwelcome in a lot of European ports, the Ivorian authorities paid very much attention to this ship.
So you were referring there to a toxic waste dump. 20 years ago, around 20 years ago, that traumatized the people of Ivory Coast. Mm-hmm. They are concerned now, but the authorities are saying it's safe. Are the Ivorian authorities saying it's safe?
Yes, because of this past, the Ivorian authority redoubled their precaution and they developed an information campaign. That's why they don't authorize the ship to dock immediately. And before, they managed to do some control, some checking about the ship by herself, the Zimrida, but also control of the cargo. And they said that as the English authorities before, because the loading of the cargo on the Zimrida has happened in England just mid-December. So they said the same as the English authority that said that it's all right, the cargo and the ship complies with all the requirements and that the cargo is safe. We think that it's a very common cargo. We can compare about the fact that it's not a good trade, but the fact is that it's a common fertilizer, it's a common product. So
yeah, except for the fact that you did say that it's supposed to be fertilizer, but the end address is a mining company. Just tell us who owns the ammonium nitrate and who is it being sent to?
There is some contradiction because for about 2 months, authorities and the ship manager said it was fertilizer. And now, since a few days, Abidjan port authorities said that the client is a mining group. So it's contradictory and it's not a satisfaction for us to see this this mix of information. Firstly, in its first press release, the port of Abidjan said that about 3,000 tons of fertilizer could be uploaded from the Zimrida, and now the quantity has doubled. It's more than 7,000 tons, and the client would be a mining group.
What would be the environmental consequences of ammonium nitrate exposure?
We have the example of Beirut with about 2,000 killed people. We had a big explosion also in France in 2001 in the south of France in the AZF fertilizer factory. It was a fertilizer factory where about 300 tons of ammonium nitrate exploded and killed 31 employees and 10 people and injured more than 2,001. So we know that also in North Korea, an accident occurred just few years later and about 200 people were killed. So it's an explosion. It's like an explosive.
So it's like a bomb.
So
it's
it
like
kills
a,
people. It's a bomb. You saw the Beirut explosion. It's a bomb. It's a bomb. And it's used. It could be used as a bomb. It's used in the mining industry in order to explode some rocks. So it is used as an explosive.
Can I just clarify something with you?
Yeah.
Is it meant to be offloaded in Abidjan or is it going somewhere else?
A part of the cargo is meant to be uploaded in Abidjan, about 1,000 tons, more than 7,000 tons. But the cargo aboard the Zimrida is about 17,000 tons. So after Abidjan, the ship will continue its journey and it will go in Rwanda and also in Tanzania.
That was Charlotte Nithard, an environmental expert and head of the French NGO Romain de Bois, or Robin Hood in English. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. It's a warm evening as sunset falls on the holy city of Touba in Senegal. A group of men dressed in colourful patchwork clothes, their hair styled in long, thick locks, are moving around a fire in a reverent circle, performing the ritual they call Samphal. Behind them is the Great Mosque of Touba, one of the largest mosques in Africa. This city and this mosque are the spiritual home of the Sufi Muslim Brotherhood called the Murid. They are also known as the Baifal, followers of a particular path of Islam, which departs quite drastically from the better-known branches like Sunni, Shia, Salafi, Wahhabi, and Sufism, which is where the Baifal find themselves. For many Sufi Muslims in Senegal, hard work is the key to their faith, but the followers of Baifal go a step further. They don't do prayer and fasting, sticking to hard work as the main practice of their faith. They're quite successful at attracting converts locally from frustrated young people and further afield among seekers in the diaspora. I've been talking about this to this year's winner of the Komla Dumor Award, Rukia Bole, who went to Touba to find out more about the Baifal. So tell us about the Baifal. Who are they? What makes them so different from other kinds of Muslims?
Okay, to give context, 95% of Senegal's population is Muslim, and the vast majority belong to one Sufi brotherhood or another. So the Baifal, they belong to the Murid brotherhood, which are also Sufi. Muridism is like the youngest and said to be the most dynamic, organized structure headed by a caliph. Muridism was founded by Sheikh Ahmadu Bamba, and his teachings emphasize the virtues of pacifism, hard work, and good manners.
How did they split from the more conventional forms of Islam?
Baifal was founded by Ibrahim Afal. He was a disciple of Ahmadu Bamba, the man who founded Muridism. And Ibrahim Afal, he led all the labor work in the Murid Brotherhood. That's how the Baifal care about hard work the most. So you asked how they're different from other Muslims. The first thing is that it's in their appearance. When you see a Baifal in Senegal, the first thing you'll see that they have a striking appearance, their dreads, the way that they dress, and most importantly, their unorthodox practices. And this has led to some people accusing them of straying too far from Islamic norms. For instance, they do not observe prayers, nor do they fast during the month of Ramadan. And instead, their devotion and worship is channeled through labor and service.
So When they work, what is the money used for? And do they get paid? How do they get paid?
So first of all, in their communities, they stay in different areas in Senegal and even beyond Senegal. For instance, the place that we visited in Dem, they had like a workshop where the women would dye clothes and then the men would be the ones who are sewing the clothes. And then those clothes go to Dakar, the capital city, and that's where they're sold. They also have different things that they work on, like they build classrooms, handicraft workshops. They even have restaurants serving organic produce from community garden. And the money is usually used back into the society. That's what they believe in, that anything that is made should benefit the community and should go back to the community. And obviously, it's moderated through their caliph or their leader.
In what ways does it diverge very strongly from other forms of Islam? Because I know that they have a holy city as well, Touba, in Senegal. And of course, in Islam, The emphasis is on that direct relationship with the divinity.
That's where the shift comes in. With Sufism, there's that connection to first being loyal to the leader, the sheikh, and then that is how you become closer to God. In Touba, it is somewhat the spiritual hub of the Murid Brotherhood. It is the Islamic Sufi order to which the Baifal belong to. And we visited the Grand Mosque of Touba, which is the largest mosque in West Africa, and it's a defining symbol of the city. There, the Murid and the Sufi Brotherhood pretty much is where they have their spirituality and their discipline, and it serves as a spiritual center for the community. The Baifal play a vital role in maintaining the mosque, in ensuring its upkeep as part of their devotion through labor and service. Another thing that was very interesting to see when we visited the shrines is that we noticed there's a room, and that's where they have like their leader, and that's who they're praying to.
I was just wondering, with the locks and the way in which the Baifal are dressed, I was wondering whether that had African nationalists. Perhaps it was a political point they were making as well about who and where they are.
Actually, one of the things that Mam Samba, one of their leaders, said is that this is Africanism. We don't have to look like Arabs for us to be Muslims. We still want to maintain our identity, our culture, by still practicing what it is that we believe in. Another thing is that it's not only the locals are part of this community. We saw foreigners, people who are from different parts of the world, who joined the community. One of them was a lady called Batuli. She was originally American, grew up in the UK, and she said that she came to Senegal around 2019 doing research, and immediately she fell in love with the community, their way of living. She said it was like a profound awakening for her. It's this mystic way of living that she chose to be part of. And we saw many, many other foreigners be part of the community when we visited them.
Okay, I want us to listen to this.
There are a lot of young people joined our community with a lot of war, with a lot of capitalist system, very difficult. There are young people who don't want this kind of life, who want to be closer to the nature, to themselves, who want to devote themselves to serve God.
So, Rukia, that's Mam Samba, is a leader of the Baifal. He's talking about the reasons why young people are joining them in numbers. Did you get this impression that people were very much attracted to the organization when you were in Senegal?
Yes. So those are one of the questions that we raised. We said, are there perhaps people who are joining your community because they need financial security and it's not about spirituality for them? They said different people have different reasons, but us, we care about what we do, which is rooted in being loyal to our leader and hard work being a way to be closer to God. But there could be an underlying reason why people join the community, that young Senegalese do not have jobs, and this community has really broadened their way of having an income. They have businesses, NGOs, buildings. Maybe young people wanted to be part of it, but the community leader said, no, that's not one of the reasons why people join us.
Now, You spoke to us about the fact that they are a political force in Senegal, the Mourid. I believe they also operate as a moral and religious sort of police force. What kinds of laws do they enforce and what kind of power do they have to enforce those laws?
So what the Bifal do is they act as a quote-unquote police where no one should behave like strangely. If anyone tries to speak to the caliph rudely or be disrespectful towards him, the Bifal would immediately step in. So in Touba, they play that role of being somewhat of a police and also ensuring the upkeep of the city.
Nobody dared do something wrong in Touba when there is a Bifal around the corner. It is the Bifal now who are making sure that everybody dresses up properly in Touba, who are making sure that people do not beat the dream and dance profane dances that can jeopardize, you know, the beauty of the system.
They are not entirely without controversy in Senegal. Just tell me a little bit about how generally they are regarded in Senegal.
Before we came, we did a lot of research, and most of the things that people were saying is that, yes, we do see the Bifal there in the capital city, Dakar, and they're famously known for begging on the streets. And once we went on the ground and we asked them, you know, this is what we've seen, this is what we've heard, is there truth to it? They said there are people who dress as Bifal, talk as Bifal, go on the streets and beg for money, but they do not take that money and use it back to the community. Rather, they just use it for their benefit. And they termed it as Bifal, F-A-U-X in French, which is false. They say those are the people who tarnish our name and give us a negative reputation to the public. And we asked, if the community is rooted in hard work, why is it that you guys allow people to beg? They said, we don't have a problem if the person goes out there and begs for money. As long as that money goes back to the community, they don't have a problem with it. But if people use it to their benefit, then they say they're not part of us.
And how is it regarded by other Muslims?
They receive heavy criticism from other Muslims in the sense that sometimes I even told they're not Muslims, you see, because if you're not praying, if you're not fasting and you're fully devoting your time to serving a leader, then they get that criticism. But they believe nonetheless that hard work is the way to heaven. As long as you're pleasing your leader, it is a way for you to get closer to God.
So what are the aims of the Mourid? Is it a growing organization in Senegal? Has it spread to other parts of the continent?
Yeah, we spoke to one expert. His name is Sheikh Sene, and he told us that the Bifal are about 700,000. That is a small fraction if you compare it to the population of Senegal, you know, but they're very impactful. For instance, let's say if a politician wants to run for government, he has to be on good terms with the leader of the Mourid Brotherhood. And if the Mourid Brotherhood tell the followers that this is the person we should vote for, they do have a big voice in the country, as well as I believe there's certain people in the Bifal community that are in prominent positions in Senegal. So they do have a big say in the country.
That's the journalist Rukia Boule reporting. Focus on Africa was put together by Amy Leibovitz and Yasha Michelle here in London. Blessing Aderogba brought her end from Lagos. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer in charge. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. And you can find us on air, online, in a podcast, and on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.